From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Manhattan at the conclusion of another cushy fundraiser. Ed Boland had worked in the fundraising world for a number of years, raising money for worthy causes, but he was gripped in that moment of feeling like what he did might not be enough. He wanted to take a risk to get closer to the kids who needed the most help. Ed wanted to teach, so he decided to leave his well-paying job and move into education. He ended up teaching at one of the most challenging schools in New York. He thought he could come in, show passion and compassion, and change lives. He thought he could reach every student, no matter how difficult. At the end of 1 year, though, Ed quit. He felt like he had been a failure in many ways. He told his friends that he was no hero teacher, but he had given it the best he knew how. And now Ed has written a book about his experiences and his ideas on how we might improve public education. The book is called The Battle for Room 314, My Year of Hope and Despair in a New York City High School. Ed is a Rochester native. He's on the line with us for the hour. And Ed, it's great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm terrific. Evan, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tell us your Rochester connection.
Yes. Deep ties to the city and to WXXI.
Oh, I don't think I even knew that part of it.
Yes. The last time I was at WXXI was in seventh grade in the parking lot trying to demonstrate a highly defective solar cooker by cooking hot dogs in front of a WXXI TV crew. And let's just say it didn't work out very well.
Well, here you are now talking about your book, and a lot of people are talking about your book. So kind of set us up for the reason you did what you did. You had a job that paid just fine. You and your boyfriend, now husband, were doing great, and you didn't have to change. You didn't have to get into teaching. What was it specifically that convinced you to try to teach?
I had been working in administrative roles and on the sidelines of education for over 10 years and in the nonprofit sector for almost 20 years. And I felt the work I was doing was critically important. But there was part of me that thought the best way to really reach kids was to teach. And I was inspired by so many of the hero teachers we see in Hollywood, Stand and Deliver, Freedom Riders, those movies where the teacher walks in and there's a classroom of disaffected kids and 90 minutes later, they're all on their way to higher education. I frankly, and maybe a fit of arrogance, naivete, and idealism, thought that I could be one of those hero teachers. And my experience was anything but that.
Well, some of the only criticism I've seen is that, you've been honest about the fact that you weren't the hero teacher from the movies, from Hollywood, and that in many ways that's kind of a myth to begin with. But at the same time, you only gave it a year, and then you wrote a book instead of sticking it out, trying to hone your approach, etc. So why do it for a year, walk away, write a book instead of kind of sticking it out?
Sure. That's a very good question, and I do hear that. There's a scene in the book, and really one of the most poignant moments of the year, when, frankly, the teacher who I thought was the best educator in the entire school, she was younger than I was. She had gone to Harvard. She'd been teaching for about 5 years. She was a literacy expert. I worked so hard that year, but if I worked hard, she worked even harder. She was there an hour before I was, meaning at 6 a.m. And if I left at 5, she was there till 6 p.m. And I aspired to be a teacher like her. At the end of the year, I watched her and helped her correct the state regents exams for world history. And at the end of it, the results on the exam were a collective 55. And I saw her kind of collapse on this pile of exams and weep. And I thought, I could spend a lot of time and energy trying to get half as good as this master teacher, and I just don't think that it's going to make that much of a difference. And so I left. And sadly, at the school where I did teach, there's been 100% teacher turnover and 4 principals since I've left. And I just didn't think I was going to contribute enough.
All right, so the book has not only a lot of gripping stories, and we're going to work through those this hour, but also a number of ideas for how we might do a lot better when it comes to public education, which I think is also a hugely important subject. But again, sort of back to that beginning, you ended up teaching what, where, and how did you get there?
So I was convinced that I really wanted to go in as well prepared as possible. So I went to the trouble of getting a graduate degree at night for about 3 years at the City University of New York, and I threw myself into my preparation. And I also did the, you know, required number of observations of great teachers, and I'd been working in an educational program and, you know, volunteered there. I really did everything I could because I heard about teachers who were in Teach for America or the New York City Teaching Fellows who have to teach their first year, which I knew would be hard, and go to graduate school at night. I didn't want to do that. So I got the degree in advance. I did student teaching for 6 months, and I thought I was well prepared, but I was anything but.
You taught in a school that had teachers who had taught in other countries. You know, it's sort of an interesting place to be. And, you know, some of our listeners might wonder, was it a charter school, et cetera? What was the setup?
It was an interesting setup. It was called officially an autonomous school. It was a fully public school. However, autonomous meant that the principal had greater decision-making power over every aspect of the school, but she was being held to higher standards. So in some ways, it had many charter school elements, but it wasn't a charter school. We were supported by the Gates Foundation. This was during the time when Mayor Bloomberg was breaking down what were typically high schools with 3,000 or 4,000 students into them, into smaller high schools with no more than 90 students per grade. And that was the spirit of the time. So we were small. We had a theme to the school, which was international studies. So all the teachers were required to have taught abroad and to be more familiar with foreign languages and foreign cultures. So it looked so promising, and the people I taught with were incredibly dedicated.
Do you agree with that approach, by the way, of breaking down those bigger schools into smaller schools?
You know, every day I saw the pros and the cons of that approach. On the one hand, I saw the tight bonds that could be formed between students and teachers in settings that small. I also saw how tightly bonded the ninth grade faculty was. We really formed a tight team. I had student taught in a very large and failing school previously. And I have to say, it was so large and so anonymous. Kids had to go through metal detectors. I think there were over 3,000 kids in the school. It was such an unpleasant setting. I wondered why so many kids showed up at all. It was really not a conducive place to learning. It didn't feel warm. It didn't feel supportive at all. So I very much like that approach about the small school movement, this creating an intimate community. However, there were drawbacks, and I saw those every day. Because we were small, we didn't have a real library. We couldn't offer our students AP classes inside the school. We had limited extracurricular activities. And for English language learners and for special education students, we had less robust offerings than a lot of the big schools. So it was a real trade-off. And frankly, the research has been mixed. On the one hand, graduation rates are up considerably, I think up about 10% in New York City schools under this method, which is very admirable. Especially with Black and Latino boys, we're seeing higher graduation rates in these settings. But at the same time, I don't know, I'm uncertain about how students are faring in terms of real college readiness. Because frankly, high school graduation rates don't mean much if kids aren't ready to compete in college.
Sure. And just for a kind of point of reference for the audience, in terms of the preparation of your students and what they knew, there was a moment in the book where you describe having spoken to another teacher who kind of told you about this lesson where the students did well, and you were determined that there would be at least one lesson where everybody got 100. Everybody got 100 on a lesson because that would improve their spirits, et cetera. And so tell our listeners, what was the lesson where you walked in, you gave them this assignment knowing that eventually they would all get 100?
Sure. And again, this was the master teacher who I was so enamored with. She said, go in the first day and wow them. Tell them everybody's getting 100 on this assignment. These are kids who've struggled in school for so long. They'll be intrigued by this idea. Make it a simple task. Make it attainable. Give them confidence. Get them all started at 100. And the task was to name the continents and oceans of the world and spell them right and identify them correctly. And I thought it was a perfect idea. But I'll tell you, after... And the trick was that everybody would take the test until they got 100. So you might take it once and nail it, and you may take it seven times. But until you get it right, you're not going to get that 100, but eventually you will. And it was a frustrating experiment because you saw so clearly the range of the kids in the classroom. There were kids who got it right off the bat, who knew it even before I taught it. And then there were kids who were on their seventh or eighth time, and it was so painful to watch. You know, they were often learning disabled or not focused. And it was a great idea, but when you have kids at that much of a range, it became really an exercise in boredom for the more motivated kids and frustration for some of the less academically oriented kids.
Sure. And again, we're just talking about naming the continents and the oceans and spelling them correctly. And again, remind the audience, the children you were teaching were how old?
These were 14-year-old ninth graders, yeah, by and large. But of course, because of the sad fact that many of the students had been held back and had to repeat grades, I had sometimes up to 17-year-old ninth graders.
So that was one episode that stands out as just an example of the challenge of helping students who have all kinds of challenges already. But the book really begins with a snapshot of chaos. And scrubbing up the language a little bit, Ed, tell us about that scene that opens the book that I think that came in, the first week? In your opening days, you come in, you think you're going to change lives, and set that scene for us.
Sure. So I had 30 students in my class, maybe 32 students, and I had what I thought was a great lesson plan, and I was trying to get the kids to focus, and chaos was breaking out everywhere. Somebody hurled a calculator at the blackboard. Kids were just openly listening to iPhones and on their phones, and it was just chaos. And one young woman who had a history of disruptive behavior before this saw the opportunity. She saw I was green. And I was really trying to rein in the chaos. I turned around. She was standing on top of her desk, and she let out a string of profanities out of her mouth that was worthy of, you know, the Howard Stern show. And I stood there dumbfounded. I knew the kids wouldn't fall into line and they weren't going to be perfect scholars, just ready, willing, and able to listen to every word I said. But I had no idea that the chaos would, that the students would feel that empowered to be disruptive that early on, especially this was the early days of high school. It was pretty shocking, and it was very demoralizing, and more importantly, how you handle your first major conflict sets the tone for the rest of the year. And I thought I was being assertive enough, and I wasn't.
Did you think at that moment that you weren't as prepared as you thought you were?
Oh, I knew within my first 2 hours of teaching that I wasn't prepared. So many of these students, this is one of the sad cycles that we see. So many of these students had gone to schools, low-performing, high-poverty schools, where in New York City, nearly 70% of new teachers will leave high-poverty schools within 5 years. So what happens then is that the lowest performing high poverty schools get the least experienced teachers. So frankly, these kids had been through so many newbies that this was almost expert sport for them. And I'm not blaming those kids. As a matter of fact, I think they deserve the best teachers and the most veteran teachers. But it was that cycle of, they had done this many times before, and they would sometimes tell me with pride about, oh yeah, we got rid of her in 2 weeks. Oh, we got rid of her in 6 months. And I was determined not to stick it out, but it just became harder and harder because you realize that this was happening to the students before, and it was happening in other classrooms in the school.
My guest is Ed Boland, a Rochester native who has been living in Manhattan for a number of years and decided to leave his job and become a teacher, and wanted to teach in one of the most challenging settings in New York City, and did that, and did it for a year, and wrote a book called The Battle for Room 314, My Year of Hope and Despair in a New York City High School. He's joining us to talk about those experiences. I could pick out so many different students. We won't be able to do, kind of have a discussion on every student in the book, but I want to touch on a few of them, if you don't mind, Ed, because there's so many compelling stories here, so many sad stories, and there was a moment in the book where there was a student named Yvette. You had this assignment where you had them watch Oh, boy. Was it the powers of 10? I got to go back
yes,
through.
All right, so, it was the powers of 10.
And tell us again, what's the powers of 10?
Powers of 10 is this magnificent short movie made, I think, in the early 1960s that takes the exponential powers and you look at a couple on a Chicago blanket. And in powers of 10, it goes to 10 times above them, 10 times above the United States, above the Earth, above the solar system, to the outer reaches of the solar system. And then it reverses and looks at the couple on the blanket and goes into the microscopic dimensions of a close-up on the man's hand, a close-up on the cell, a close-up on the atom. So it gives you kind of a sense of your place in the world.
It's a cool idea, and I know you were hoping it would sort of inspire the students. Instead, what you saw was not a whole lot of interest, but then something happened with, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was Yvette, right? You were.
It was Yvette.
All right, so you're reading through some of what these students wrote about it, and all of a sudden, you came to that. Tell us about it.
She wrote the most beautiful thing. She was a disengaged student, and I saw that she was furtively really watching this movie, and she was getting it and absorbing it. So when the lights came on, and I asked everybody what they thought, they said, oh, this is mad boring, it's corny, stupid, and you know, really just dismissed it out of hand. But I knew that she was intrigued, so I asked her to comment on it. And she was surly and said, I'm not interested in this, I don't know what you're talking about. And then we did a writing assignment on it, and I was going through the assignments that night at my dining room table. And most kids, you know, scribbled a few things. There wasn't much of a reaction. And then I got to Yvette's paper, and there was a beautifully and poignantly written paragraph about
Can I read
how
it?
This movie... I'm sorry.
Can I read it?
Please do.
Because I realize I'm the one who's got the book in front of me right now. I should read what... So here it is. So you come to what she wrote about it, and she wrote... this is what Ed writes. In an elegant script, she wrote, quote, I see the Earth. It is sparkling, blue, beautiful, and so far away. The solar system looks like the atoms, and the atoms look like the solar system. It's all the same, really. I know where those people on the blanket are, but where am I? This is an interesting movie. And she ended with an urgent plea. Please don't tell anyone I wrote this. Remarkable, because she had this moment of beauty and expression, but she was scared for people to find out. What did you do with that?
I tried to approach her in a private way to tell her that her secret was safe with me, that I thought she was a beautiful writer, and that I knew that this movie really resonated with her. And she had such a traumatic upbringing. This is someone who, this is a student, and it's hard to say, but she had prostituted herself during middle school, and she was an outcast as a result of it. And I remember she was so angry and so well defended that when I tried to broach it with her, she acted like she'd never written it. And I just remember thinking, there's so many kids like this who are so curious and so observant, and their life circumstances are interfering with their ability to explore that curiosity.
And this is where, this is where your book goes from Hollywood to real life, because there's so many scenes that are so gripping, but you don't get the Hollywood ending. I'm sitting there reading this going, wow, Yvette's having this breakthrough. And then all of a sudden you hit the brakes and you said, you wish you could say that that was the seed, that this beautiful flower grew, that this student, you know, kind of blossomed, and it didn't really happen, did it?
Those stories help us sleep at night, but sadly, they're not often true, the Hollywood hero stories. And I'm not trying to be cynical, but I want people to realize that what makes for a good Hollywood movie makes for bad education practice. And when we rely on teachers to fix all of the social problems our students arrive with in the classroom, it's not practical and it's not fair. And I want people to understand that, because not only is this, you know, the stuff of movies, this is the stuff that many reformers out there are saying we must do. All you need is an effective teacher year after year in front of the highest poverty kids, and we can turn them around. And it's true, we can turn many children around, and we can have some success, but those successes, really real sustained successes, are few and far between. And I want to focus on the kids who even the best teachers can't reach, because we need to understand their circumstances and how we can really help them.
But there, I have to admit something, Ed. Reading your book, there were moments where I was almost shocked. I mean, I understand the emotion you felt. I think it sounded like you were surprised at how much some of those individual students, at least in individual moments, you found yourself almost hating these students. How could they behave this way? They're sabotaging a lesson. They're sabotaging another student's opportunity. And, you know, ultimately, one of your conclusions is that we need to reach those students more than any others, that we must really champion them, even the hardest ones. But in those difficult moments, you found your emotions really, really tough, didn't you?
I am someone who I thought had tremendous patience, tremendous professionalism, and I was, by the very early on, within 6 weeks, I would say, fully depressed and unable to perform my job. I did things and said things that I wasn't proud of. I remember when I was looking for a job, I went to several small schools, and I would observe teachers where I saw students talking to teachers in horribly disrespectful ways, or I saw teachers letting kids put their heads on the desk and sleeping. And I remember thinking, what's wrong with these teachers that they would let kids talk to them like that, or let kids sleep on the desk? 6 months later, I found myself being talked to far worse than they were. And I was happy when some of my most disruptive students would come in and put their heads down. So it was easy to judge from afar, but when it was me, it was very humbling and very instructive.
Before I get to some of our listener phone calls, and I see the phone starting to ring. Listeners, if you want to weigh in with questions or comments for my guest, Ed Boland, the author of the new book about teaching in New York City, the book's called The Battle for Room 314. You can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're here in Rochester, 263-9994. Ed, it didn't take long for you to decide that when it came to language, at least you're in your classroom, if you're out in public, out somewhere else with kids, you know, you're going to put on a sharper, stricter face. But you got to compromise a little, I guess, right? I mean, you're not going to call them out for every curse word, every slur, because you wouldn't have anybody left in class after half a day.
Have anyone else in class, and you wouldn't have time enough to do it. So you made practical accommodations about what you were able to tolerate inside the classroom and outside. Some people might not think that's good educational practice, but it was the triage I had to perform.
Let me grab Paul in Lakeville, who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Paul.
Good afternoon. I'm excited to hear about the existence of this book. I'm a retired teacher who was in New York City from 1991 until 1998, teaching in one of the big, completely chaotic schools for part of that time, and a second half of the time teaching in a school that almost functioned like a regular high school. But the behavior patterns and the baggage and the difficulties, I was also teaching ninth grade, by the way, an English
tough
teacher
year
in my case. But the one thing that I did during my stay in New York that I remember with some sense of achievement was I started an after-school program involving the performing arts. I went to the principal after being there about 3 months, and knowing that this school with 2,000 kids on the books and about 1,000 showing up every day had a completely empty auditorium and no band and no chorus and no theater program at all. And so I said, you know, what about this? And he said, well, it won't work. The kids are, they'll steal your stuff, they'll have fist fights, they won't show up, they'll do this, they'll do that. And, of course, I was witnessing that sort of behavior all day long. But the thing that happened was that we found a small group of kids that grew over the period of a couple of years to about 20 who developed a sense of commitment and a sense of interdependency and a sense of a willingness to express their creativity and to develop some skills. that far exceeded anything I was getting done during the day in the classroom.
Paul, it's so interesting you say that, because one of the things I find so discouraging about the current over-testing of kids is that arts are often being forced out of the curriculum at the expense of test prep. And I witnessed what you witnessed, and that is the arts, the most successful lessons I had involved the arts.
I was just going to say, Ed, I want you to eventually tell some of these stories, because I don't want people to think there are no success stories. There are some remarkable moments in the book, but go ahead, continue.
And the best lesson one of the best lessons I had, you know, involved art and students reacting to art. And whether it was the music of Lil' Kim, who we listened to one of her songs and had to decide if Lil' Kim got justice under the Roman system of law, if she had been a Roman citizen.
I love it.
Or we looked at the Dogon couple, a famous African sculpture. Kids really saw art as a way in. And also, I told the story about that highly disruptive student who stood on top of her desk the first week. What I found so interesting is what eventually worked with her is there was a great dance program at the school. And I learned that this is the one thing I had over her. I said, Shantae, you have to perform today or I'm not going to let you dance. And that was the key. That was the key. She wanted to dance so much that she fell into line most of the time.
You also had a few other lessons. I mean, we could talk more about, you know, just your teaching approach and how much you learned there. But, you know, telling the story of Andrew Carnegie, we could talk about, you know, ancient Rome, graffiti, you know, all these things that you decided that you could do to reach them more effectively. And I think that is the mark of a creative teacher. And sometimes it's art that leads into lessons outside of art. I mean, it's not always just an after-school art program or a music program. Sometimes it's using art. Sometimes it's using the art that they know, you know, the music that they listen to, et cetera, to be the way in, yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to find a hook. And I had one great mentor at the school who said, concentrate as much as you can on that first 5 minutes of introducing a lesson and find a way in that they will find relevant. And once you hook them, that is your way in and the way you can get them to do content that might not otherwise be appealing to them. So I focused a lot on that. But again, I want to go back to the fact that I heard so much in graduate school, people saying, if you get great lesson plans, discipline will handle itself. And that was the worst advice I got, because I really did focus on my lesson plans, some of which on paper were beautifully crafted pieces of things that went absolutely unheard. So you have to have both. And I do want to talk about the success stories when you're ready.
Sure. Actually, let me get another, let's see, I see the phone ringing again here. Melissa in Honey, I Falls, we lost you. If you want to call back, we'll grab your phone call. I see the phone ringing again here for Ed Bolin, my guest for the hour, the author of the book, The Battle for Room 314, My Year of Hope and Despair in a New York City High School. You know, you had Yvette writing what she wrote, asking you not to tell. And unfortunately, you didn't make, you know, sort of a deeper connection with her as a student. But you did have little moments where students, you know, would leave you a note. Thank you for never giving up on me. Things like that. That lead me to believe that as much as you felt like a failure, you had to have those moments where you said, you know, these are some of the most challenging scenarios I can imagine. And at least we're making progress.
I do want to share one story,
yeah.
Astonishing story, just quickly, about this young woman who had been in foster care since middle school. And she, in the year before she came to us in eighth grade, had been homeschooled on the New York City subway system by her birth mother, who was brilliant, but troubled. And this young woman came to us actually pretty well prepared, but I think 1 or 2% of kids in this country who are in foster care will get a college degree. And I have to say, 2 years ago, I was so overjoyed to go to the college graduation ceremony of this young woman. It was extraordinary because of the 90 kids I taught, only really 3 or 4 graduated from college on time, and the fact that she was one of them was extraordinary.
Well, there are some stories in the book like that that give you hope that if you're a teacher, especially if you know a teacher, you can relate, I think, to what Ed's gone through. I want to get a short break, and I want to talk about some of what Ed would like to see change when it comes to education, public education, how it's done. I mean, he'll tell you he doesn't have every single answer, but I think there are some very interesting ideas from segregation to poverty to, as Ed already talked about a little bit, higher ed and whether that's really preparing teachers to teach in some of these challenging environments or whether that preparation could become more practical, more real world. So let's get a break and continue with the author of The Battle for Room 314 next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the Next Connections First Hour, it's Unleashed, the Pet Show. We're talking about your animals, veterinarians taking your phone calls and questions, and we're also looking at cats. A new study indicated maybe they'd kill you if they had a chance, but the authors say that study's been misinterpreted. We will explore it. Then second hour, answering some of your medical questions about new breast care guidelines. That's Friday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the estate of Robert W. McKnight, whose bequest to this station provides ongoing support for news coverage and public affairs programming on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. My guest, Ed Boland, was not a teacher in his for many years in his career. I guess 20 years in the fundraising nonprofit world, Ed?
Yes, and also in college admissions, in the Fordham and Yale admissions office.
Right, and so became a teacher and decided he wanted to try to reach students in one of the most challenging settings you can imagine, and worked in that school in New York City. A lot of the names are changed in the book, but the experiences are real, and a lot of people talking about the battle for room 314. Let me grab another phone call. This is Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to call and follow up on something that was said that kind of dovetails with an observation and something that I've become to believe firmly. My daughter is a graduate of the School of the Arts, and she was also an athlete and went to college on an athletic scholarship. And I think that one of the things that we overlook when we are talking about the success of schools and the success of students is why sports and arts have such an impact on kids' lives. And I just wanted to make this observation that I have come to believe that sports and arts both in at-risk situations tie youth to caring adults. Ed made the point that he had the young woman standing on her desk who he said she wasn't going to be able to participate in dance if she didn't buckle down and do her work. But so that gives people, students, an incentive, but it also says to them that I'm going to be connected to an adult who really cares about what I do and what I achieve.
Chris, thanks for the phone call. Ed, what do you think?
Absolutely. You know, I think we talked about the arts, but when it comes to sports, the discipline, the teamwork, the ability to deal with failure and rebound from it, those are such valuable lessons. And one carries over from the other. And sadly, I think so many schools are defunding athletic programs and, again, finding less time for it. But I think there's even good research that shows that you know, kids have to be physically active in a very healthy way in order to really focus to their full ability. So I couldn't agree more.
Chris, thanks for the phone call. It's a great point. And, you know, when you read Ed's book, if you grew up and went to school in sort of what I would call a privileged setting, this will shock you in many ways. And that's why I think Chris's phone call reminds us that when we talk about, well, we're going to try to cut funding or maybe we'll cut art, we'll cut sports. Maybe we'll do it as a penalty. Maybe we'll do it as a funding mechanism. You know, you see the consequences when you start to see the stories of the kids in this school that Ed was working with. You think about Rochester. You think about the value that some of those things can have. And frankly, when you think about, you know, where we are as a society, Ed's book brings even more clarity into the question of segregation. I mean, Ed, just to be blunt, we are still so segregated, aren't we?
In all candor, we're not just segregated. We have created an educational system that is approaching apartheid. And when you look at the 50 states and you look at the history of segregation in this country, first of all, the overall fact that our schools today are more segregated than any other time since 1968 is a crime. But the fact that a place like New York State, not Alabama, not Mississippi, not Georgia, but New York State has the most segregated schools in the union is a crying shame and one we need to address. Not only for moral reasons, not only because every classroom should reflect the broader community. But we also have research that shows in integrated schools, low-income kids perform better, and middle-income and higher-income kids don't perform any worse.
Right. It's not a zero-sum. Exactly.
What about the ability to sit next to in a lunchroom with kids that don't look like you?
Yeah.
I read an amazing report by the Century Foundation about school segregation. There are 4 million white people in New York City. There's a good chance that many, many students in our system, say a Latina girl from the Bronx, she can go from pre-kindergarten to 12th grade graduation without encountering a white student in her academic experience. We need to look at that long and hard and ask ourselves, why is that the case?
Well, and, you know, Ed, I think in this community, there have been conversations about changing the setup. We've got, you know, 19, 20 school districts in the county. So we're not like, for example, Wake County, North Carolina, which in the mid-70s, they combined urban and suburban districts into one, but there were only two to combine, not 20. But they did that,
right.
And they said no more than 40% free or reduced lunch. We will bus kids. We will sort of even it out that way. And in many metrics, they are doing much better. And as Ed said, it's not a zero-sum game. A lot of parents, kind of parents of privilege, they think, well, if the kids in poverty do better, well, then whoever they're going to school with are suffering in some way. And that is not always the case in education. It's not necessarily a zero-sum game. I just kind of wanted to make the point that the research is not always, you know, not always clear on that. But I think some of the research indicates, Ed, that what you're saying would be logical if we had the political will. I just don't know that we're ever going to have the political will in Rochester and New York State. Do you?
Evan, I am more hopeful than I was. I know that sounds like a crazily optimistic statement at this point in our political process, but Eduardo Porter of the New York Times just did a fascinating article about a joint paper from the Brookings Institution and the American Enterprise Institute about finding common ground on reducing poverty. I'm beginning to feel that this is such a pressing and practical matter that we will be able to find middle ground on it. In the same way that many people on the left and the right are coming together slowly about prison reform and about sentencing laws, I think poverty eradication can be an area of shared interest and focus. I'm getting more hopeful that both sides can come together on this, because we have 51% of American school children are now eligible for free or reduced lunch. Let's think about that for a second. Most kids in American schools are struggling financially. And we see that comes out in their academic performance. So this is not just a fringe issue for a very small segment of the population. This is an enormous issue of economic, moral, and social import.
Let me grab another phone call. Jane in Rochester's got a question about how you helped kids who came from poverty, families, and trauma, and that was most of who Ed was dealing with. So go ahead, Jane.
It was mentioned that the children come often to school with a lot of baggage, and there was no detail on that, but that's not hard to believe at all. But I want to challenge a little bit this idea about sports. I know Evan and I don't agree on this, but there's a downside to the sports that I see, and that there's such an overemphasis on winning and a narrow definition on winning. It comes from coaches. It comes from everywhere, from parents. And I hate to see children socialized into that sort of thinking, rather than as opposed to, well, did I do better than I did before,
yeah,
and not comparing yourself to other people. So I really differ on that, on the sports and the way it's taught and what it offers to children. But anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, Jane, thank you for the phone call. I will just say, I think we can be way too obsessed with winning and losing as a culture. But at the same time, Ed, I think realistically, I think Jane's heart is in the right place there. But realistically, for some of the students you worked with, if you took sports out of their lives, you know, whatever the case may be, what's the impact for at least some of them?
Absolutely. It's. I think it played a critical role. And I think Jane and I would, and you and I would agree, there's a right way to do sports and there's a wrong way to do sports. And like I said, the American obsession with winning is not the most constructive way to do it. But what about teamwork? What about resilience? What about coming back from failure? Those are the values we need to inculcate into our kids, not win at any cost. So like anything in life, there's a right way to do it with the right values or the ineffective way. So I think that she would agree with that too. I think anybody would, that there's a right way and a wrong way to do it.
Let's go out to Spencerport. Kati is next. Go ahead. You're on with Ed Boland.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious, a common question. Why did you pick New York City to do this in, having spent 61 years of my life in New York City and then moving up here? I decided to, I was teaching in the suburbs of New York, and then I decided to sub here. And I found the same issues in some school districts up here. One school district I refused to sub in anymore because the children were so amazingly disrespectful and rude to me and to each other. Because most people see it, they hear, oh, New York City, what do you expect? You know, everybody's got problems in New York City. But it's not true. I've seen it up here. It's amazing.
Ed?
Thanks for the question. I had lived in New York. I'd gone to Fordham for college and stayed here. So this is my hometown now. I mean, my hometown is Rochester, but this is my adopted city. And I saw the pressing need every day when you get on the subway and you know that there are kids going to school, and and I knew that they weren't going, in many circumstances, to the best schools, and wanted to play a role in that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kati. We're talking to Ed Boland, whose book is The Battle for Room 314, My Year of Hope and Despair in a New York City High School. Ed, do you suspect that, you know, New York City is the most extreme? I mean, Rochester is a city that, for its size in the country, has more poverty than any other city its size, more kids in poverty, and more people in extreme poverty. The state average rate for graduation, 78%. But as of June, the four-year graduation rate here, 46%. And if you include by August, so giving kids a couple extra months to finish, it's still only 50.9%, 27 percentage points below the state average in Rochester. So in many ways, it feels like your work would translate. Do you suspect that's right?
I suspect it would be right. And since I've had so many family members teach in the Rochester Public Schools and friends who currently do, I know that the issues are exactly the same. You know, poverty is poverty is poverty. And I just really wanted to hone back to that point, is the root of educational failure is poverty. It's not bad teachers. It's not unruly kids. It's not uncaring parents. It's not protective unions. It's not flabby curriculum. The root of educational failure is poverty. And we need to embrace that idea and do something about it immediately.
All right, before I grab a couple of other phone calls here, I do think, to some degree, Ed, people will pick up your book hoping to confirm their own biases about education. And I think the people who think public schools are broken will pick this up, and they will find plenty to support their idea. Just as the people who think that poverty is the chief problem, as you just said, will also feel strengthened by what they find in the book and some of your prescriptions at the end of the book. But, you know, I do think there are moments in the book where you confront your own feelings. You know, you talk about your own sort of personal biases, but you had moments where you think you're looking at this kid, you're looking at a family, and you think we can't just blame poverty, that we have to do better in some way. You know, we can't just excuse it because of poverty. And I know you kind of wrestled back and forth with that a little bit.
I did. Of course, I wanted the school and my classroom for personal responsibility to be an absolute value. This is the toughest thing to balance, is how do you hold kids accountable for their behavior? Because if you don't hold them accountable, you're sending them off into the world with the wrong message. And no employer is going to put up with what teachers put up with. And society is not going to put up with that behavior. So on the one hand, you wanted to hold kids personally responsible for their behavior. At the same time, you knew they were being set up to fail. I had kids walking into my room every single day who had problems that I know adults, if they had one of the problems these kids had, and these kids had more than one problem, they wouldn't be able to function at their job effectively. And yet here was a 14-year-old kid, one of my kids, Freddie, no father in the picture, a mentally ill mother. they were on the verge of being evicted from public housing because Freddie's brother was dealing drugs out of their apartment before. He himself had a criminal record and was on the verge of going to jail. He walks into my classroom. I'm handing him a sheet on ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. How is that relevant or helpful to the kid? This kid was not especially disruptive. He was not a good student.
Right.
But how can we expect kids dealing with those kind of issues? We've set them up to fail, and it's not surprising they're acting badly because they feel outside the contract. They feel outside the deal. They know. There's very few people in their world who have been rewarded by playing the game right. And they see that they are not beneficiaries of the system, so why should they buy into the system's values?
Sure. And before we finish the hour with a couple phone calls, I will say, again, we've talked about segregation. Ed is really endorsing an idea that will try to push us to desegregate in some way, which I think Ed is not alone in thinking that. He talks about poverty, and obviously that is a very difficult problem, but that's at the root here. And higher education. Ed, in your own experience, there's a lot of ivory tower, nice theory that in the real world quickly disintegrates if you don't know how to break up a fight, if you don't know how to deal with it, if a kid brings a weapon to school. If you've got a kid like Mateo who shoots a girl in the head with a pellet gun, a girl, by the way, that he liked, and he was influenced by somebody else in the class, and then this poor kid Mateo ends up taking the blame for it, and all these dominoes are falling, you might not deal with that in higher education. Do you think higher ed has got to do a better job at saying, okay, especially for teachers who are willing to go into these challenging districts, we're going to change the message. It's not going to be all theory, pie-in-the-sky stuff. It's going to be more practical.
A resounding yes, Evan. I can't speak for every education program, but I have to tell you, all the first-year teachers, whether they had gone to, frankly, Ivy League schools of education, if they had gone to, you know, regional ones, no matter where they went, everybody said, why didn't we do more emphasis on classroom management? Why was the training so theoretical, so philosophical? You know, they keep stressing, you know, oh, you have to know your subject and you have to know the content. Of course you have to know that. But you can't get that content across if you don't have classroom management down. And I wish that I had been put in front of master teachers to show how they deal with disciplinary situations. I wish that I had been shown videos of how people deal with a disruptive classroom. I know some schools are starting to do more practical approaches, and that makes a sense. It makes so much more sense. I know someone who suggesting doing improv is a way to figure out how you would react in certain student situations. I spent several semesters doing, you know, Piaget's theory of child development and Bloom's taxonomy and so much theoretical approach to this that was frankly useless.
All right, let me grab Philip, who's been waiting, and he's calling from Syracuse. Go ahead, Philip.
Hi, good afternoon. To a gentleman on the radio, I actually attended one of the schools in New York City around that time, 2007 to 2009. At the time, I was a new immigrant to the country, and that was one of the schools that I actually ended up attending for 2 years before graduating. After graduating, I ended up working after college in a boys' home of children with issues, behavioral issues, in upstate New York. My question is, what policies would you like to see, policy actions would you like to see taken to actually ameliorate these conditions? Especially with poverty, I mean, down there, I guess it was mostly a minority community where you would have these issues with poverty. But up here as well, when I worked in the group home / boys home, it was mostly based on poverty. There were a more diverse background of clients or patients, I guess, or students, but the same issues as well. So.
All right, so Philip, we're down to our last 2 minutes. What's the specific question for Ed?
So what policy actions would you like to see taken to address ameliorate the issue?
Thanks very much, Philip. Go ahead,
Ed. I would do three things immediately. Number one, We must continue our focus on what we can do within the four walls of a classroom, but we need to do a lot more outside of the classroom. Number one, we need to pass a living wage so that families are more economically stable. They can help kids with homework. They can show up for a parent-teacher conference if they're not working two jobs. Number two, I would end mass incarceration for nonviolent offenses. We have 2.7 million children in this country who have parents who are incarcerated. We know that's going to academically waylay them. And number three, we have to pass comprehensive immigration reform. The smartest kid I taught, an absolute genius, never went to college because he was an undocumented student. He is 23 today. He could have graduated from college and be contributing to the economy, and he never went to college because of his undocumented status. Those are three things I would do immediately. And neither of those, none of them, would cost us an additional tax dollar. And as a matter of fact, they might reduce taxes and increase the number of people who are paying taxes.
The book is The Battle for Room 314, My Year of Hope and Despair in a New York City High School by Ed Boland, who's been my guest for the hour. Ed, do you ever wish you had stuck it out a little longer, that you're still teaching today? Do those urges come up? Do you think, this is what I'd do differently, this is what I'd do better?
I struggle with that to this day, Evan. But ultimately, a friend of mine who's very blunt, said, you know what, maybe you weren't good at it. Why would you continue with something you're not good at? You're obviously much better at getting this message out than you were at teaching. As blunt as that was, I think he's right.
Well, I know it's a conversation that many communities are having, how to fix education, and there's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. Do you fix schools or do you fix poverty? And in many ways, this book does endorse the latter, that it has to start with
no,
poverty.
No, Evan, I beg to differ.
Okay.
We need to do both and, not either or.
Well, definitely fair enough. Absolutely. and let me thank you for taking the time, Ed, as a Rochester native. Coming back on Rochester Radio, it's great to talk to you. And for our listeners who kind of just got a taste of it, there's so many other stories in this book that are so compelling, and it reads in so many ways like a novel. It's The Battle for Room 314. It's out now. Thank you, Ed. Good luck with the book, and thanks for taking the time for the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Ed Boland, my guest. And thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of this broadcast, Megan Mack, the producer. And thanks to Kate Cowie Haskell, our intern this week. Thanks to you for listening to member-supported public radio. We'll talk with you on a Friday.